as we rely more and more on electronic voting, it is incumbent upon us to make sure that we understand the integrity of the process.
Well, there's a good idea from a very bad man.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Oh, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
Yep.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle.
Oh, they're everywhere.
Yes, I'm stuck in
from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. In Grand Rapids on WPRR. In New Orleans, get out and vote, New Orleans. On WHIV, they got elections on Saturday. In Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR. And Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every damn day on the internets on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow with his hair on fire from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining me. Keep your fire extinguisher nearby. You may need it this hour. We have got news on that race last week in Kentucky where Andy Beshear, the Democratic challenger to Kentucky's unpopular far-right Republican Governor Matt Bevin, is said to have unseated the governor by just over 5,000 votes out of some 1.4 million cast, which Bevin refused to concede on election night, calling for a re-canvass that happened on Thursday. That would be citing evidence-free claims of voter fraud last week, but this week citing concerns about electronic voting and tabulation systems. Aha! Well, we have news on today's re-canvass shortly, Bevin's reaction to it, and much more on those concerns about the unverifiable electronic voting systems that are currently set for use next year in key battleground states like Pennsylvania and Georgia, despite their horrific failure during their first use tryout in last week's off-year municipal elections in those states. Susan Greenhall of the National Election Defense Coalition will undoubtedly be here to share my own burning hair about all of this and the use of these systems in next year's critical 2020 presidential elections. But today, as we have a very brief break in the hot impeachment action in the U.S. House, actually, we have no time for this, Desi, but do you have that Nancy Pelosi clip today?
This is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in the Democrats' regular weekly scheduled press conference discussing the impeachment hearings.
Talking down to the President of the United States in about as brilliantly a way as one possibly can.
And if the president has something that is exculpatory, Mr. President, that means you have anything that shows your innocence, then he should make that known.
She's not wrong.
No, she's not. Just talking down a little bit. What does exculpatory mean? Anyway, thank you. With that short break, we'll have a fresh green news report a little bit later for you this hour. Our 1,001st.
Not 1,001th.
Not 1th. No. That's thanks, by the way, to those of you who helped us celebrate GNR 1000 on Tuesday and the listener supported GNR and Bradcast every single day with a very much needed donation at bradblog.com/donate. Please write it down. Well, before we get to that, we have a lot of, let me hit a few other news items here. We sadly had another school shooting today, this time here in Southern California in Santa Clarita, a suburb just north of us here in Los Angeles at Saugus High School. Six were shot, including the shooter, early on Thursday. As of airtime, two are dead, a 16-year-old girl and a 14-year-old boy. Three other shooting victims are also 14 and 15 years of age. The 16-year-old shooter is said to be in grave condition as of airtime after a self-inflicted gunshot wound with a .45-caliber semi-automatic pistol. In less grave news, Donald Trump lost again on Wednesday in his desperate but so far completely fruitless legal battles to keep his tax returns from being disclosed. As Reuters reports today, the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia said on Wednesday it would not revisit an October decision backing a U.S. House of Representatives subpoena issued to Donald Trump's accounting firm, Mazars USA, seeking his financial records, like his tax returns. The 8-3 vote against Donald Trump by the full U.S. Court of Appeals in D.C., declining the president's request to rehear arguments that the subpoena to Mazars was illegitimate, brings Democrats closer to shedding light on his business interests and how he built his fortune, at least in theory. In a statement, Donald Trump's lawyer Jay Sekulow said the president would now appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Yes, that would be the Republicans' stolen U.S. Supreme Court, on which two of Donald Trump's appointees now sit. And just as we go to air here, apparently it is official. They have filed that request with the Supremes. The House Oversight Committee subpoenaed Mazars this year, saying it needed records to determine if Trump complied with laws requiring disclosure of his assets and to assess whether those laws need to be changed. Trump sued the House panel in April, arguing that its subpoena exceeded limits on Congress's investigative power. A lower court judge ruled against Trump in May. The decision was the first time a federal court waded into the tussle about how far Congress can go investigating Trump. A three-judge panel of D.C. Circuit judges in a 2-1 ruling upheld the lower court judge in October. Judge Naomi Rao, who was appointed by Donald Trump to the D.C. Appeals Court, dissented from that October decision. Rao and another Trump appointee to the court, Gregory Katsas, who used to work in the White House legal counsel's office for Trump before he was put on this D.C. Court of Appeals,
for a lifetime appointment,
voted to rehear the case as well. According to Wednesday's order from the full D.C. Court of Appeals, the two Trump appointees were joined by an appointee of former President George H.W. Bush and opposed by eight others on the court. Now, that case is separate from the one that Trump recently lost in the Federal Court of Appeals in New York, where he had sued to block New York prosecutors from subpoenaing his tax records from Mazars in the state investigation into Trump's pre-election hush money payoff to porn stars with whom he had affairs, campaign finance felony conspiracy, that is, for which his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, is now serving time in jail. That would be a criminal case that Trump is hoping to block in New York. And it's also separate from another case that was dismissed by a federal judge in D.C. just days ago, where Trump attempted to sue the state of New York over their recently adopted law allowing the U.S. House Ways and Means Committee to obtain New York state tax returns, potentially from the president if they want them. So Trump has lost every single one of these cases in every single court he has been in. So now the Supreme Court is his last hope. I should say the Republican stolen Supreme Court. His appeal would require just four votes for there to be a review of the case. Five votes if the Supremes want to put a stay on it. Otherwise, his taxes would almost certainly be released to both the U.S. House and the Manhattan District Attorney very soon. Meanwhile, the race to replace the hands-down worst, most corrupt president of all times continues to expand. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick announced on Thursday that he will run for the Democratic presidential nomination. It remains to be seen how many were actually clamoring for him to do so. His late entry comes as the filing deadline for the February 11 New Hampshire primary. That, by the way, is less than 90 days away now. That deadline is on Friday. Patrick ruled out a presidential bid earlier this year, and now he's going to face some big hurdles in an already crowded field. But he says that while he respects the candidates in the Democratic field, he says if the character of the candidates is an issue in every race, this time it's about the character of the country, says Governor Patrick in his introductory video, which we also don't have time for, unfortunately, today, maybe in the future. Patrick served as the governor of Massachusetts from 2007 through 2015. Prior to that, he worked in the Clinton administration as an assistant attorney general in the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. And, well, this seems important. After leaving the governorship, Patrick joined the investment firm Bain Capital. Have you heard of that?
Yes, we have.
Notably co-founded by Senator Mitt Romney, Republican of Utah, as its managing director. He may, yes.
And there's a little bit of additional. Earlier than that, he was also vice president at Texaco.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. That's okay. Probably going to not go over well with the kids
these
days.
In a Democratic primary, he might want to consider running for the Republican nomination, though. There may be a slot open there. In any event, Patrick may not be the only conservative Democrat jumping in late to the race. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is said to be deciding soon whether he will do so as well. Of course, there are still elections, never mind 2020. We still have elections in 2019. Voters are heading to the polls on Saturday in Louisiana, where Donald Trump and Republicans are scrambling to avoid another Kentucky-like embarrassment before 2020. They are both the president and the RNC, now going all in the gubernatorial runoff in Louisiana that happens on Saturday. They are apparently spooked by a spike in high turnout by Dems during early voting. Politico is reporting the RNC just poured in an additional $1 million in a last-minute get-out-the-vote effort. Trump is stumping in the state on Thursday night, and Vice President Mike Pence is calling into local radio stations on Friday. Sadly, there are not a lot of progressive or Democratic or liberal radio stations on our airwaves anymore, although we do have the fine WHIV in New Orleans, the voice of dissent, which is carrying the broadcast 5 days a week. So there's that. Who shall call into them? No, we're doing that. We're calling into them.
Get out and vote.
Let's see. Well, after incumbent Governor Matt Bevin's stunning apparent loss in Kentucky last Tuesday, Trump is now reportedly very worried about watching another candidate who he endorsed and campaigned aggressively for in a southern red state lose another election following his humiliation last week with Governor Bevin in Kentucky, who he had rallied for on the night before the election. Trump's preferred candidate down in Louisiana is Eddie Rispone. He's said to be facing an uphill battle as African-American turnout. It has reportedly bounced from 25% in the primaries up to 31% now in early voting for the runoff. Democrats comprise 46% of early voters so far. That is up from the 44% in the primary. Most polls now have the race very tight, giving incumbent Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards a slight edge over the Republican. On Saturday, voters in Louisiana will cast their votes, however, on 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems across the entire state. So whoever is named the winner, whether they actually won or not, will be the winner. And yes, That sort of thing remains a problem, a big one, not just in Louisiana, but in a bunch of battleground states where brand new, unverifiable systems failed miserably last week, leading Republicans, apparently ousted Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin, to actually, dare I say it, be right about something. Yes, news on Bevin and why my hair is still on fire today and probably will be for quite some time, unfortunately. Susan Greenhall of the National Election Defense Coalition joins me to help me explain, though I doubt she will put out my fire. Maybe she will help light yours. I'm Brad Friedman. You are listening to The Bradcast.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Yes, I am. Yes. My hair remains on fire. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Your hair should be on fire too, but okay, put it out for a second. Let's start in Kentucky. Each of Kentucky's 120 counties spent about an hour on Thursday morning double-checking the vote totals from last week's off-year election day, so-called re-canvass procedure, requested by the state's incumbent Republican Governor Matt Bevin after he apparently lost his re-election contest to Democratic challenger Andy Beshear in the otherwise very Republican state by about 5,000 votes, a little bit more than 5,000 out of some 1.4 million cast last Tuesday. The state had already begun preparing for a new administration in the days prior to Thursday's re-canvass. The House Republican caucus had invited the apparent Democratic governor-elect Beshear to its annual retreat to discuss areas of possible policy agreement. Senator Mitch McConnell, who the New York Times describes as the major domo of Kentucky Republicans, told a reporter for the Lexington Herald Leader on Monday that, quote, barring some dramatic reversal on the re-canvass, we'll have a different governor in 3 weeks. Well, there was no dramatic reversal in Thursday's re-canvass, as expected. That is essentially simply a double check of the computer reported results to make sure that they were added together accurately. Virtually no results changed in Thursday's re-canvass, and just before air, Bevin said, according to NBC, that he will not contest the results. That means he's conceding, I think, and it means a Democrat will be the next Kentucky governor. But on election night, November 5, Bevin declared that he was not conceding this race by any stretch. That's a quote. Adding, quote, well-corroborated irregularities must be examined, including what he described as thousands of illegally cast absentee ballots, though he offered zero evidence to support his so-called well-corroborated claims of voter fraud. He also offered an offhanded reference to concerns about electronic voting machines that same night. And by this week, prior to the re-canvass, when interviewed by Louisville's ABC News affiliate about those well-corroborated irregularities, Bevin was very vague, though he cited no evidence on those particular irregularities. He did offer repeated references to being unable to trust results reported by the state's unverifiable touchscreen voting systems and its optical scan tabulators.
As we rely more and more on electronic voting, in the digital calculation of things and the electronic calculation of things, it is incumbent upon us to make sure that we understand the integrity of the process and that it is not able to be manipulated. There is no question these same machines that are used here are used in other states and they're used nationally. So there's certainly good reason to believe there's correlation between a lack of integrity or confidence in integrity in a process in Kentucky and in any other race that might take place. The real question is there confidence in the voter logs themselves? The digital data that was taken, can it be relied upon? All Americans want to have confidence in the electoral process. They have to believe that their votes are counted, that they are counted legally, and that there is integrity in the process. We have to believe that the process works. And in an electronic day and age, there's increasing concern that that may not always be the case.
Well, the governor from Kentucky, who initially cited false claims of thousands of illegal votes cast, is unfortunately not wrong on these points concerning our electronic voting systems. While there's been no evidence of note to support Bevin's concerns that votes may have been tabulated incorrectly, there likely would be no such evidence to speak of when it comes to any and all touchscreen voting systems used in the states. And the only way to assure hand-marked paper ballots were tallied correctly is to count them by hand, a count that Bevin indicated today he will not be seeking. But the fact that he was citing concerns about unverifiable and unverified results in truth should be a concern to many voters on all sides of the political aisle for a number of reasons, even when these machines work as planned. Even when they are not misprogrammed accidentally or on purpose or hacked by foreign or domestic actors, it is often impossible for anybody to know if they tallied results as per voters' intent. That is always true when it comes to touchscreen systems that record votes inside the machine, or even the newer touchscreen computer ballot marking devices, systems that use printers to mark so-called paper ballot summaries on the voter's behalf. After an election on those sorts of systems, even one where the machines worked as designed, voters cannot know after an election if reported results are accurate, because we cannot know if any voter actually verified the computer-marked papers, much less if they verified them correctly to assure that even one ballot reflects even one voter's actual intent. Nonetheless, in a number of other states beyond Kentucky last week, there is boatloads of evidence that brand new touchscreen computer ballot marking devices, or BMDs, that are being deployed to key 2020 battleground states like Pennsylvania and Georgia before next year's critical presidential election, did not work as they were sold to work by the private vendors who sold them for hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars, by the way, to elections officials. The wildly expensive brand new computer voting systems failed spectacularly in a number of places in their first tryout in both Pennsylvania and Georgia last week, even as counties in more than a dozen other states plan to use these very same unreliable, hackable, and 100% unverifiable voting systems next year. That, despite election integrity and cybersecurity experts begging those locations, including even here, my home county of Los Angeles, the nation's most populous jurisdiction, to use hand-marked paper ballots instead for the arguably most important elections in the history of this nation. As we've been detailing on this show since last week's election day, Bloomberg News finally noted last week that the first sign something went wrong with Northampton County, Pennsylvania's state-of-the-art voting system came on election day when a voter called the local Democratic Party chairman to say a touchscreen in her precinct was acting, quote, finicky. As she scrolled down the ballot, the tick marks next to the candidates she'd selected kept disappearing. Her experience on November 5 was not an isolated glitch, according to Bloomberg's Kartike Mehrotra and Margaret Newkirk. Over the course of the day, the new election machinery, brand new machines, bought over the objections of cybersecurity experts, continued to malfunction. Built by Election Systems and Software, the ES&S Express Vote XL was designed to marry touchscreen technology with a so-called paper trail for post-election audits. Instead, it created such chaos that poll workers had to crack open the machines, remove the ballot records, and use scanners to conduct a recount that lasted until 5 a.m. Of course, there is no way of knowing if those ballot records on the computers actually reflect the intent of any voter. In one case, it turned out a candidate that the XL showed getting just 15 votes had actually won about 1,000 votes. The local paper, the Morning Call, described what happened there, said in the contest for county judge, Democrat Abe Cassis reportedly received zero votes in a whole bunch of precincts on election night. He was initially shown with just 164 votes total out of more than 100 precincts reporting. It turned out he didn't have 164 votes. He had 26,142 of them. Nonetheless, that is the type of voting system that we are now moving to here in Los Angeles and across all of Georgia and in counties in Pennsylvania, including Philadelphia, and in New Jersey and North Carolina and South Carolina and Ohio and Texas and many other places. And yes, my hair is on fire about this and is likely to stay that way unless and until these folks change course and allow a verified hand-marked paper ballot for every voter in this country. I really do not think that folks are fully appreciating the potential fire that is being played with here for next year's election, and I guess I need to be the one to make that clear on the airwaves anyway, because Lord knows the Chuck Todd industrial complex is not doing so. In Bloomberg's surprisingly good report on this, as they noted, finally, as we have been yelling and screaming for months in advance of all of this, in Philadelphia, a three-person election commission discounted cybersecurity warnings and in February selected the ES&S Express Vote XL after a massive lobbying effort by the company. That in opposition to election experts advocating for a much cheaper and verifiable hand-marked paper ballot system instead. Those experts were ignored. And yes, those systems in Philly also failed last Tuesday, forcing many voters to wait for an hour to vote during a sparsely attended off-year municipal election. Imagine what next year will bring to the key swing state of Pennsylvania in the most Democratic part of the state. In Georgia, where the state's Republican Secretary of State is also deploying similarly new unverifiable ballot marking devices made by a different vendor to the entire state next year, despite warnings from experts, those new systems failed in four of the six counties where they were being piloted for the first time last week. Bloomberg quotes Susan Greenhall, vice president of the National Election Defense Coalition, as saying that too many election officials have been convinced by vendors and colleagues that spending more money and deploying more technology will result in a better, safer election. She said these elaborate election systems benefit companies' bottom line far more than the taxpayers and voters paying for them. Her nonpartisan nonprofit group is now calling for Pennsylvania to decertify these new unverifiable ballot marking device systems before next year's critical 2020 elections. Susan Greenhall is vice president for programs at the National Election Defense Council Coalition, and she has been researching and working for years on state and federal policy regarding election verifiability and security. She has for years been a critical voice in this fight, though I think it may be the first time we've had her on air, at least in modern times, in any event. Welcome to the broadcast, Susan Greenhall.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I am really worried, Susan. I'm really worried about next year's elections with these new unverifiable voting systems really proliferating in key battlegrounds like Pennsylvania and Georgia, but in dozens of other places as well. It is not being reported much. It seems the media usually wait to cover it until it is too late to do anything about it. But do you share my concerns about the 2020 elections?
What is really concerning about these ballot marking devices is that there's been a false equivalency created by the vendors, and I think it's been accepted by many people in the election official administration space and in the election community at large, that there is a paper record there, so therefore the voting system is verifiable. And the problem is that all evidence that we have to so far to go on indicates that that paper record, that the expensive touchscreen ballot marking devices that you described so well, is not actually verified by the voter. And that's the critical point. That's the whole reason we've been advocating for years for paper ballots. That's the whole reason that the National Academies of Sciences have come out and said we need paper ballots, why the Senate Intelligence Committee bipartisan report said we need paper ballots, because it creates that, or it provides that physical artifact of voter intent, which is not hackable by some malicious cyber actor.
Well,
and it provides something that can be used to audit the election results. And
well,
if it's not, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you described described the several groups there as calling for paper ballots, but these officials are describing these things as paper ballots. Don't we need to make the distinction between hand-marked paper ballots and what these folks are now describing as paper ballots that really aren't, that are computer-marked, you know, paper summaries of the vote?
Yeah, I wouldn't even call it a paper ballot. I would call it a ballot summary card. And we need to make the distinction that it doesn't achieve the same or doesn't contain the same properties that paper ballot that we know is a hand-marked paper ballot provides, with inherent verifiability inherently verified because the voter has marked it. I've heard people argue that those of us that are insisting on the need to have an inherently verified hand-marked paper ballot have moved the goalpost, and I think that is exactly untrue, because for years, and you know, Brad, because you've been around as long as I have, when a long time ago when people were looking to replace DREs and there was a move to paper ballots, the term paper ballot meant a hand-marked paper ballot as well as a ballot marking device that would be provided to anybody that has any need for assistive technology in marking that paper ballot, and that was the system that was that people were referring to when we said you need to replace DREs, and it was accepted. And as states moved from direct record electronic machines, or DREs, to paper ballots, they adopted hand-marked paper ballots with assistive technology for those that may need it. And in states like Maryland, in states like Florida, in states like California, as that transition happened, that's what happened. And then it was just a couple years ago that the vendors introduced ballot marking devices that produce ballot summary cards that don't produce a ballot that looks the same as everybody else's ballot, and made the declaration that this is exactly the same. Well, no, we don't know that it's the same, and just because they've told us it's the same, we shouldn't automatically accept that it is. The vendors who have gone out and introduced ballot marking devices that produce ballot summary cards instead of a MarkSense paper ballot that will mimic the same or look the same as a ballot that somebody marks by hand, they've moved the goalposts, and that product does not provide the same verifiability and the same auditability as a hand-marked paper ballot, the assertions that it does are unfounded.
And to be clear, no one is against an assistive device for people who choose to use it, whether they're disabled and they need help in voting with such a device. That's one thing. And that's already required by federal law under HAVA and the American Disabilities Act, that there must be one such machine in each polling place. But what these companies are doing, and I would suggest tricking many of these elections officials into falling for, is that, oh, everyone needs to vote on one of these machines, so you have to buy 10 or 20 or 50 or however many people you want to be able to vote at one time in your precinct, using these machines that, after the election, as I noted and as Susan suggests, they're unverifiable. We don't know if the voter actually checked the vote to make sure they're accurate. And this is a problem, Susan, I would say a bipartisan issue across the board. You heard me cite Matt Bevin's concerns, never mind that he was noting conspiracy theories about voter fraud. The points that he was making about having confidence in the reported results is real. He is a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. At the same time, in Pennsylvania, Republicans were filing lawsuits in regard to the disasters that happened in Pennsylvania and Northampton. And while Georgia's Republican Secretary of State is pushing these machines in that state, Democratic run counties like Los Angeles and the city of Philadelphia are also supporting the new use of these machines as well. So I hate to both sides this thing, Susan, but yeah, both sides seem to be really screwing this up bigly at this point.
Yeah, I won't disagree. I think, you know, you can find people on, but at the same time, there's people on both sides of the aisle that will be proponents of hand-marked paper ballots that are inherently verified. So we have people, you know, on both sides of the aisle getting it right, and people on both sides of the aisle getting it wrong, which is unusual. But at the same time, it's something that shouldn't be partisan in any way. We need transparent elections. We need secure elections. We need accessible elections for all voters. That benefits both parties, or all parties. That benefits every voter. And I've heard it said we need a system that the devil himself could run, and you can still trust the results. It needs to be transparent and verifiable to the electorate, and that means it's something that's auditable, that the voter knows that the election results are correct, and that the election officials can prove it. And there's no room for just trust us in this. We shouldn't have to trust the vendors. We shouldn't have to trust the election officials. We should all be able to see and verify for our own eyes through observation and auditing that the election is being conducted in a fair and accurate manner and a secure way. And anything less than that is unacceptable in a healthy democracy, or one that aspires to be healthy. We can't have that.
Yes, and I like the devil himself. I used to say we need a system that Catherine Harris in Florida could run and would work, or J. Kenneth Blackwell in Ohio could run. I guess I need to update that now to we need a system that Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State in Georgia, can run, and the people can oversee it. Election officials, however, in Northampton and Philadelphia, certainly not Republicans, they insist that because these machines print this computer-marked ballot summary, whatever we want to call it, that voters could not vote on them for an hour or so, several hours during the early rush last Tuesday, or that the computer reported results did not match the paper printouts because they could just rely on the paper that they pulled out of these machines, these so-called backup paper ballots, as Senator Amy Klobuchar always seems to describe them, that we could just simply rely on those. Now, you're calling for those very machines to be decertified, your group, National Election Defense Coalition. So are those officials wrong when they say, hey, we got the results, look, here's the paper?
Well, we don't know that they're right. That's the important thing. And the reason we don't know that they're right is because, so first of all, the paper that is in that specific machine, that machine is especially difficult to verify the ballot, because the ballot summary prints behind a piece of glass, and the font is very small. And according to the Secretary of State's own examiners, they were unable to verify the vote choices printed on that ballot summary card because of the orientation under glass and the position on the on the machine. When these extraordinary problems happened on Election Day, some members of the local parties went to court, and a judge hearing this actually said, I'm going to paraphrase, but he said something pretty close to, you're telling me my vote might not be counted because I didn't check a piece of paper in the lower corner of the machine? Come on. So he was saying he had no idea he was supposed to verify that piece of paper.
Go ahead.
So, and all evidence that we've been collecting so far, although it's not in a scientific controls and so forth, indicate that people are not actually verifying those ballots. So when we saw these very crazy results, as you mentioned, that showed that there was a problem in the tabulation, and there was undeniably a problem in the tabulation, the vendor and the local officials said, well, that's okay, we'll just use the paper, and we'll count from the barcodes that have been recorded on the paper, and we'll rescan the ballots on different machines that will be able to tabulate them correctly. But that's making the assumption that all of those ballots recorded the votes properly. And I don't think that that is a fair assumption or a reasonable assumption to make when these machines already failed so spectacular to tabulate. How do you know that they did the recording portion of their job correctly when they couldn't do the tabulating portion of their job correctly?
And that's my point. That's my fear that, you know, that this question, the one that you just asked, will be the one that comes up after Election Day in 2020, whether it's the general election or the primaries that are kicking off in less than 90 days, Susan. Is it already too late to do anything about this? I know you're calling for the systems in Pennsylvania to be decertified, but voting begins, like I say, in some states in less than 90 days at this point. Is it too late?
Well, implementing hand-marked paper ballot systems, fortunately, can be done in very quick order if it's absolutely, if it's needed, and states have shown us that they can do that, like Maryland and Virginia. So it's not too late to fix that. What we need is the will of the election officials to make it happen, and then it can be done. You're exactly right about the concern, and what's also very troubling to me is it doesn't take much for people to look at that and say, well, these machines didn't count right, so how can you know that they recorded right? And I don't need to be, you know, an insider or a computer security expert to be able to say that it's not a fair assumption to say if it failed on one side, we don't know that it actually worked properly on the other side. But that people are trying to stand up and tell us something that on its face is not supported. And that always really troubles me, because we want to have confidence on our election systems and in our election administrators. Mm-hmm. But it makes it harder if they're going to say things that don't kind of pass the
smell test.
Logic test, let's say.
Yeah, and there's a difference, by the way, in having confidence in those officials and simply trusting those officials. And we don't have time to get into it, but I know the National Association of Secretaries of State has now launched a campaign called something like Trust Only Us. I think that's what it's called, literally, urging citizens that they should only trust election officials when it comes to election information. And that, you know, information, I would argue, that we should be able to see for ourselves. But that said, very quickly, I've got just a minute or so. The Bloomberg article that I cited, Susan, reports that cybersecurity experts are baffled by local election officials choosing these computerized voting machines. They they quote a frequent guest on the broadcast, Rich DeMillo, who I know you know as well, a Georgia Tech computer science professor. He used to be the chief technology officer at Hewlett-Packard. He said, "It's a mystery to me. Does someone have 8x10 glossies? No one has been able to figure out the behavior of election officials. It's like they all drink the same Kool-Aid." You, Susan, have worked with many of these officials for years. I'm always asked, you know, what are these people thinking? So what is your explanation for why so many of them, as I note, in Republican and Democratic districts alike, seem to continue to ignore the experts and simply trust, yes, they trust the voting machine companies, even though they've failed them over and over and over for decades now?
So I am going to caveat that because I know, and it's easy to focus on the problem areas, but you and I both know some people who have been doing amazing jobs trying to protect elections. So we know that they are out there.
And some officials are great. Yeah, no question.
Yes, you and I know some that are excellent.
Yep.
So it's some. It's not all. I don't know what the answer to that question is. We were involved in exposing the fact that ES&S had a secret board of advisors that was composed of election officials who were treated to free trips around the country to Florida and Las Vegas and New York City on ES&S's dime. Mm-hmm. We don't know if the other big vendors have similar arrangements. Although I'll say Hart explicitly denied it, but Dominion would never answer the question. But I'll tell you where you can draw a line there. In New York, in New York City, or the executive director of the New York City Board of Elections, who was on this ESNS board of advisors, wrote to the state board and said, we absolutely need to buy these express vote XLs, the ones that failed in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
This was earlier this year, in March, I believe. And it's so imperative that we get them because it's the only way we're going to be able to run our elections on, in, for now that New York has early voting, which was just passed.
Mm-hmm.
So we need you to waive to the state board of elections. This is the executive director of the New York City Board of Elections,
mm-hmm.
writing to the state board saying, we need you to waive the testing and certification process so that we can buy these machines right away. And the state board, to their credit, composed of some of those excellent election officials that are out there, said hard no. You can't do that. We need to be able to test these machines. Now, is that a coincidence, or is that is there something else going on there?
Well,
I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, well, it was not a coincidence in Philadelphia, where ESNS, as you referred, was found to have been lobbying these election officials for years and were recently fined, ESNS was, some $2.9 million for not reporting it properly in the state. But you know what? That pales in comparison to the tens of millions of dollars they won on contracts across that state. And I'm not saying that these election officials are being paid off, but I think when you've gotten to know someone for years and you fly them out to Vegas and you wine them and you dine them, then you end up sort of trusting them. And as Susan Greenhall correctly said, our elections are not about trust. They are about verifiability and oversight by the citizenry. Susan, we're going to have to pick this up on another day, as I suspect this fight is going to continue. But boy, am I happy you are out there making it. I would urge people to check out your Twitter feed, which is S.E. Greenhall, and you spell Hall H-A-L-G-H-S-E Greenhall. And you can also, of course, find her work. She is vice president for programs at the National Election Defense Coalition, which you can find at electiondefense.org. Susan, really delighted you joined us today, and hope we won't make it another 10 years when you do it again.
Thanks very much, Brad. Good to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I tell you what, I am really worried, and I'm going to continue hopefully worrying you about this as well. I shouldn't be the only one to have my hair on fire about this, and we're going to keep talking about it so that when things, if things, as I expect,
go south
in the primaries next year and potentially in the general election. Susan says there's still time to switch over to a hand-marked paper ballot system, that it's easy and that it can be done anywhere, even here in Los Angeles. Are you listening, Registrar, Recorder, County Clerk, Dean Logan? At least you won't be able to say, broadcast listeners won't be able to say they were not warned. All right, well, going from my hair on fire to Desi Doyen and the entire planet on fire, sadly, things only get better, see? A quick break, and we are back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report right here on the broadcast. You're welcome.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1978. That was the day OSHA published its lead standard. The standard reduced the permissible exposure by 75% to protect nearly a million workers from damage to nervous, urinary, and reproductive systems. As early as 1908, Alice Hamilton, the mother of occupational medicine, noted that lead had endangered workers as far back as the first half century after Christ. In their book, Deceit and Denial: The Deadly Politics of Industrial Pollution, historians Gerald Markowitz and David Rosner add that, throughout her distinguished career, Hamilton was deeply involved in uncovering the relationship between lead and disease in the American workforce. Hamilton's groundbreaking research on the effects of lead paved the way for a growing uproar against its continued use. After the Occupational Safety and Health Act passed in 1970, occupational and public health activists pushed hard for a lead standard. A new generation of industrial hygienists hygienists emphasized how unsound industry-driven conclusions regarding safe lead levels impacted women workers and workers of color. Industry had long asserted that women and African Americans were simply more susceptible to lead poison, which served to justify discrimination in hiring. Some unions accepted these terms, if only to demand a stringent lead standard that included immediate implementation of engineering controls. But leading hygienists like Gene Stelman blasted these arguments. Stelman insisted such conclusions reflected racial and gender bias rather than any credible scientific evidence. She added that men, women, and children, regardless of race or ethnicity, were all adversely affected by lead exposure. The final standard adopted was considered a compromise. Discrimination in hiring has continued and enforcement proves difficult. But even a watered-down standard was too much for the lead industry. They have been fighting it ever since.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently, without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Okay, so maybe the whole world on fire is an exaggeration.
Slightly.
Given the huge Arctic, what do we call that? The polar
vortex.
Vortex, yes, that is at least chilling much of the U.S. But these fires in Australia now that have been going on for days are just absolutely huge and wicked and scary.
Yes.
And of course, covered in our latest Green News Report.
We've seen bushfires, but what we're experiencing at the moment, it's something else, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Catastrophic fires hit Australia. Arctic blast hits much of the U.S. Plus,
there's absolutely no scientific basis for doing this. They didn't even identify what problem they're trying to solve.
Trump EPA seeks to limit science used to write public health rules.
All of that madness and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Climate crusaders homing in on a new target to save the planet.
Liberals are coming for your Thanksgiving turkey. We'll tell you about it next.
No, they're not. But that's what they're telling you on Fox News. Yep, this is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, over on Fox News, they must really, really not want to talk about impeachment, because on every single show over there, they're talking about liberals coming to steal your Thanksgiving turkey.
And of course, Fox News is lying. They are outraged about an article on Huffington Post that simply offered ways to reduce your environmental footprint on Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah, well, now you know. Now you've been warned. So when your crazy uncle comes on over for Thanksgiving, you'll know why he's so mad.
Meanwhile, in actual news,
thank you,
a blast of Arctic air has brought extreme cold to more than 200 million Americans in the lower 48 states this week, breaking century-old records. While it's not unusual to have cold weather in winter, it is unusual for it to hit this early in the season. We're still more than a month away from the official start of winter.
So your crazy uncle who watches Fox is going to be mad about the turkeys, and he's going to be saying, what climate change? It's freezing outside.
Well, you can also tell him that it's really unusual to break this many extreme cold temperature records all at once.
Well, he won't listen.
Scientists say that the warming Arctic is changing the jet stream that drives weather systems across the Northern Hemisphere, and this loopier jet stream causes cold Arctic air to spill far south like a freezer door left open.
So a warming planet is causing colder weather. Good luck selling that to your uncle.
Well, hey, it's in line with climate scientists' predictions of more frequent extreme weather, including extreme cold. In Australia, hot and dry tinderbox conditions are fueling catastrophic bushfires. This week, officials in Queensland and New South Wales declared critical fire warnings, the highest designation, as more than 100 early season fires raged across eastern Australia amid soaring temperatures and crippling drought. As of airtime, at least four people are confirmed dead, thousands evacuated, hundreds of homes destroyed. Officials said it is unusual for intense bushfires to start so early in the season and so close to populated areas. An Australian government science report last year warned that climate change is making Australia's bushfires worse, but saying so has become a political lightning rod. Conservatives this week criticized environmental groups for mentioning the climate change link, but the mayor of Glen Innes, Carol Sparks, fired back.
Her name is Sparks?
Yes.
She fired back?
Yes.
It's not a political thing. It's a scientific fact that we are going through climate change, and of course it's not relevant at the moment when people's houses are burning, but the overall thing is to deny climate change is, to me, a very ill-informed and uneducated way of looking at things.
That's it. She's uninvited for Thanksgiving.
It's also unusual to see major wildfires in both hemispheres on the planet simultaneously. Thanks to man-made global warming, Australia's fire season and California's fire seasons have now extended to the point of overlapping.
Which is odd, because when it's summer there, it's winter here, and vice versa.
Exactly. Meanwhile, here in the United States, the Trump Environmental Protection Agency has proposed a new rule to limit the scientific research the agency is allowed to use to determine public health regulations. The Trump EPA this week proposed to disallow all public health studies in which the full data isn't made public, including confidential patient medical records. It's a change long sought by polluting industries, according to Dr. Andrew Rosenberg of the Union of Concerned Scientists on a recent broadcast, because it would deprive the EPA of the data justifying pollution standards.
This isn't about transparency. This is about restricting the ability of the government to do the job that we want them to do, that is to protect public health and safety. And people need to know that.
Yeah, they're basically outlawing science.
Finally, Brad, you had asked how Swedish teen climate activist Greta Thunberg is going to get back to Europe after the upcoming UN climate conference was switched from Chile to Spain.
Yep.
Well, after her whirlwind tour of North America, Thunberg and her father are hitching a ride on a zero-emission sailboat with a young couple and their baby.
Very nice. Safe travels, Greta, and thanks for all the hell-raising. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. And our thanks to those of you who helped us out by stopping by bradblog.com/donate to celebrate GNR's 1,000th episode. This, of course, is 1,001. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Come sail away, come sail away, come sail away with me, lads.
Can I sail away with Greta? Can I do that?
It
can
sure
I
does sound nice. It's going to be a rough crossing, so of course, best wishes for her on that.
And by the way, I'm not sure that I do want to sail away with her, because was it Venice record flooding now
Venice, Italy, yes. They have they're just now experiencing the second highest tide ever recorded, and it's only the sixth time that St. Mark's Basilica has been flooded in 1,200 years, the four of the last six floods that hit St. Mark's Basilica all hit in the last 20 years.
You know, it's like the climate is changing or something.
Yeah, it's like something scientists have been telling
somebody
us about.
Really
that people
ought to do something.
Aren't doing anything about it
yet. About
yeah.
that, yeah. Okie doke. Well, another episode where we end by saying you can't say we didn't warn you.
True. But you know what? Hey, if you're in Louisiana, you can be warned. You can get out and vote. And you know, you can also be a vote Sherpa. You can help other people vote. You can reach out to other folks you know who are in Louisiana and help them get together what they need to make sure they get out and vote on Saturday.
Yes. And we will all pretend that the results are accurate, even though they are 100% unverifiable. But don't let that stop you from voting. Bad guys ain't got to steal your vote if you give it to them. by not voting. All right. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. My thanks also to my guest today, Susan Greenhall of National Election Defense Coalition, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. We always appreciate it. If you missed any version, any part of portion of today's show, you can download it and any version of it you like at bradblog.com for free. You can find me on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. You can also drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And yes, as ever, we thank you for being a listener sponsor of The Bradcast and The Green News Report by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. But we'll try best that